Hey, this is Josh at the Thieves. I'm talking to Sunal Edamaruku. He's the founder and president of the Rationalist International and the president of the Indian Rationalist Association. And he's dedicated most of his life to exposing gurus, godmen, medical quacks, and others making supernatural claims. He's perhaps best known for the Great Tantric Challenge of 2008, where he challenged a tantric to kill him live on television, and several hundred million people watched that fail. Most recently, he's drawn attention for the public criticism of Satya Sai Baba, a very famous and influential godman who died recently. Sunal, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Hi, hello.
Hi. So were you ever religious, or were you brought up questioning these kinds of things? You got involved at a very young age, so how did that happen?
In fact, my parents came from two different religions. Father was a Christian, and mother came from a Hindu caste. And when they decided to marry, they have decided that the child should opt his religion when he become an adult. And nothing should be indoctrinated. No religion, I mean, neither rationalism, nothing, nor atheism, but he should simply grow as an individual, knowing everything, and he should decide his future. And I've decided by the age of 14, for rationalism and scientific temperament, and I got involved in the student movement of the rationalism.
Did you ever study sleight of hand? A lot of skeptics here in the U.S. had done that. Was that something that got you into it, or did that just come along with studying?
Yeah, in India there was a rationalist movement that was established in 1949, which was mainly influenced by the British colonial time. I mean, lot of free thinkers and rationalists have been influencing Indian thought process at that time. And especially Bertrand Russell has been a great influence in India. And the movement, the Indian Rationalist Association, started in 1949, before my birth. And I have been a part of the student movement, and later I became active in the movement. Along with my studies, I've been active in the movement. And perhaps at the age of 27, when I became the General Secretary of the Indian Rationalist Association, I was the youngest ever national leader of the organization. I've been completely involved from my youth time, exposing miracles and superstitions and blind beliefs, because I have been really moved in my childhood seeing what was happening around me.
I sometimes get a little confused with the titles. Like, what's the difference between a guru and a godman? Is there any?
Well, guru in Indian, all Indian languages, from Sanskrit to Hindi to any other language, the word meaning is a teacher. And most of the people who are claiming that they are religious teachers, religious preachers, try to claim that they are a guru. But the very term can be easily used for a teacher also in any Indian school. But a godman is a person who claims that he himself is God incarnate, and he himself is God, like Satya Sai Baba. Satya Sai Baba claimed that he is God himself, and he has created the universe. And there were many people to take it.
Yeah. I was hoping to get to him in a little bit, but what about Fakir? Is that how does that work into this?
Yeah, Fakir. I mean, the terms are as follows. A fakir is a person normally who is denouncing the worldly pressures, and maybe a wandering person. It could be a sadhu also. If it's a Hindu, normally we say it's a sannyasin who has denounced material life and wandered for spirituality. And if it's a Muslim, one would say a fakir. The term is intermittently used. Fakir is more Urdu, and sadhu is Hindustani.
How does mainstream religion in India, does that play a part in all this, or are they doing something separate altogether?
I beg your pardon?
Does mainstream religion play a part in this whole godman scene, or is that something separate?
The most interesting thing about the whole phenomenon of godman or guru or baba or all these kind of things, There is, in practical usage, the definition and clear distinction vanishes. And a person who could be a Baba, means a fatherly figure, could be just a Godman. And a person who claims that he is a sadhu could be a person who amasses a lot of wealth and has a big empire, like Baba Ramdev, who was one of the biggest Ayurvedic empire in the country, and he calls himself a Baba or a sadhu. So these terms are used as per the convenience of any of these self-proclaimed guru or Baba or Godman, because there is no system of a seminary or a theological education, I mean, in Hindu structure. Anybody who finds a saffron cloth wear on him and claims himself to be a guru is a guru, and if he claims that he's a Baba, he's a Baba, and if he claims that he's a Godman, yes, he's a Godman. It's very simple.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between in our sort of New Age movement here in the U.S., I noticed. So these guys sometimes get political power. What kind of policies do they push for?
Most of the people, I mean, there is a general tendency that if you wear a person on saffron cloth, the man of the street immediately go and bend in front of him. Anybody who is wearing, orange saffron cloth is a holy man for the common folk. So you have a wide variety of these kind of people. On any given holiday, you may have a sadhu knocking your door and asking for alms, or there could be another sadhu or baba who would be giving a big lecture. There will be 1,000 people listening him, or another one in a Cadillac car comes and huge mansion where a lot of people are recruited and kept as virtual prisoners, as his permanent disciples who cannot go out like any other cult or sect would work. A wide variety of these people all around. We have nearly 100,000 people who are involved in this God business, and 7,000 people are apparently Godmen.
Wow, that's incredible. One of the things I struggle with in trying to study this kind of thing is who's a real believer and who's a conscious fraud? And it seems like a lot of the line between the two is a little clearer in India, because you actually, you know, put these claims to empirical tests. So is that the case? Is it easier to delineate between who's consciously defrauding people and who might have just be a little kooky?
I would say that, you know, there may be serious spiritualists also in the country. There must be a lot. Those people who are in saffron, who call themselves a guru or baba, I would categorize them into three categories. The good guru, bad guru, and the worst guru. The good guru, I would say that, for example, a person who thinks that he has to do something in the spiritual world, try to influence some people in the spiritual world, maybe give some lectures about religious texts, as well as do some social work and try to reform the religion. There are some people like that, like Swami Vivekananda, who was in the 19th century, who has been a great influence. That's one pattern of guru. Or Swami Dayananda Saraswati, who was a guru by himself, but tried to fight against the caste system and social divisions. I would not like to criticize these people, because though I am an atheist, I would like to say that if somebody is satisfied with their work, if they are not exploiting people, if there is no crime involved, I have no objection. Let them go and do their work. But the problem is the majority of these gurus, these babas, are sheer exploiters. Some of them are mental patients who believe that they are real gods. And there is a coterie, a mafia work around them and present them in front of the gullible common people and make an empire around them. Another group of people are sheer shrewd people who just do sleight of hand, little tricks, and work on simple chemistry and physics to make, fake miracle claims and get people believe that they're doing great things. So these are the kind of people we have, and the majority of these people are classified as people in deceit, in cheating, working on hoaxes.
Now let's move on to the tantric challenge from a few years ago. Were you ever nervous that he was going to actually not kill you by psychic means, but he had a knife at one point, and I was kind of nervous watching that he might try to sling at you or something.
that was a very, I did not expect that was going to be such a hit. And in fact, that was a panel discussion which was happening in a television program, and I was invited to be in the panel because one of the former chief ministers of a state in India, Uma Bharati, she claimed that she had a lot of problems. She has hit on the door of her car, she has some ulcers on her feet, and she has lost a local election. She thought her enemies are doing black magic on her. So the channel decided, well, we have a discussion with a black magic work on politician. I've been there, and this guru was there. While the discussion began, he has brought a little material which I identified as wheat dough, and he said, I have a small doll made out of this thing, and if I triangulate this doll, the person with whom I am trying to trouble will get suffocation. If I put a nail on him, he will get pain, and if I smash it, he will die. I said, that's absolutely baseless. That's a live program. I was aware of the danger of what he was speaking because millions and millions of villages, the common folk, are seeing this television program. And whatever I say, when a guru says like this, so confidently that he can kill people with magic, people are going to believe it. And I thought there's only one way to challenge him. I said, if that works, why don't you just kill me? So first he said, no, I don't want to, young man, you are too enthusiastic, you'll be killed. But I challenged him, provoke him, and then he had no other way but to start. Maybe he really believed that I would get unconscious or die. It continued. The channel decided to stop the next program and continue with that. I think it went on for 2 hours. And at the end of it, he was so tired, and he said, oh, maybe you're protected by some gods. I said, I'm an atheist. Which god is going to protect me? Then he said, well, in that case, there is an ultimate destruction ceremony, but you have to come in front of a fire in the night at 11 o'clock, Friday, which was the same day possible, and wood from the burial ground has to be brought, and there will be a lot of people chanting mantras. And what would happen is, in 3 minutes, you will get crazy, next 3 minutes, you get unconscious, and the next 3 minutes, you would die. But it's unreversible. I said, fine, wonderful, go ahead. And that was it.
Yeah. Was there any follow-up from that?
In the first part of the program, there was not much danger because it was unexpected for him. It was quite spontaneous. The whole action was spontaneous, and I suddenly challenged, and he was not expecting this thing. Though, even in that situation, he tried to make some kind of a trick because when I was not fainting or collapsing, he asked for a knife. So he brought a very open knife and played in front of my eyes and neck and all. Just to scare me, maybe. If I was not confident enough, I would be scared and fall down afraid or something like that. But I was very sure that it's in front of live television and nothing could happen. And if anything happens, I'll be immediately taken to a hospital. I was very sure about that. But in the second time, after 5 hours when it happened, I thought of a lot of possibilities. Of course, I was sure that no tantric power is going to work on me, because it's for the people who are afraid, because if they're afraid, of course they are affected. Since I'm not afraid, and I know that it's absolutely baseless, there is no meaning. But he could use poison, he could use chloroform, he could use any kind of phosphorus-based toxic material on my skin. I thought of all these possibilities, I discussed with experts, and I decided to keep 4 or 5 feet away from him, and any material brought in front of my nose or my body, I've made a condition that it should be first brought to his nose. That was the only condition. And he tried for 1 hour. At the end of it, well, the man was very fat.
Nice. All right. Now, the other method I saw on this documentary, Guru Busters, was that some of the rationalists would go on by bus to some of the fakirs and gurus and replicate their effects, what they were doing. There was a guy with claimed to be creating a fireball, but But one of the rationalists showed that it was just an explosive compound that he was using.
That's a very wonderful, and successful campaign that we started in 1990s, and which I initiated in Kerala at the time, in southern state of India. And the first part of Guru Baptist, you see me, and we have been traveling all around India, covering 1,000 villages, reaching out people directly. It was a roadshow, basically. We went to people, talked to the villages, and asked them what's the major superstition there, what are the gurus speaking there, what they're doing exactly. And we had an expert team, youngsters, maybe university students. We replicated what was the miracle of the village. And we tried to explain people what exactly it was. And it worked like magic. People were so happy. Unlike many people thought, it was welcome everywhere, and people were hugging us and encouraging us, and it was a big, big experience. Many people warned us it would be very dangerous. People would take it provocative if you are hurting their religious sentiments. So we took a position that we don't want to take away your belief or anything. We just want to explain how gullible you are sometimes, how you are cheated sometimes. You are cheated not by anybody else but the people whom you are trusting. Therefore, try to understand what's happening. This is how it is happening. And that has been simply, simply successful. And we could directly talk to thousands and thousands and thousands of people every day. And in 3 months, we could cover all over the country 1,000 villages.
That's great. That's awesome. Last subject. I just wanted to cover Sai Baba. So he died recently on Easter Sunday. Did the fact that he died on Easter overshadow his prediction of living until he was 96, since he was, 84?
When he died on Easter, there were many people still believing that he would resurrect, because nobody really believed. All his devotees seriously believed that he would not die, despite he was on ventilator for quite some days. Because he has predicted so clearly in November 23, that was his birthday, that he would die at the age of 96 only. And this prediction he has made earlier also. And everyone virtually believes that he would come out. And there have been even discussions that if he remains on ventilator, his the managing trustees of this organization even planned to keep him on ventilator till 1996. But nothing worked. His system was going down, and he died like any other man. And there was a very interesting question which was asked by the media, whether he was treated like a god or as a human being. So if he was a god, he could have simply coming out of the whole thing. So the trustees of his institute said he was treated as a man. Interestingly, many of his devotees were completely upset with this prediction totally failing, because he himself has been claiming that he has saved a lot of people from grave dangers, from accidents, from air crashes, from heart attacks, a lot of things. A lot of people really believe that if they came out from any ailment, it was simply because Satya Sai Baba helped them. And I've heard people telling that, our flight had a problem, and Sai Baba just came there and held our flight intact. He would very proudly claim such things also. Unlike the other gurus who would say that if something happened, he said, the God has done it, I've been a mediator only. Satya Sai Baba would simply say that, I did it. So somebody is on a surgery for heart, comes out successfully, he said, yes, I was there. I saved you. That's how he said it. This confidence has given a lot of serious dependence on him. A lot of people, all his devotees, dependent on him thoroughly. And when he died, they were completely frustrated.
Yeah. I would think more of the followers would start questioning, all that confidence he has in himself when he admitted himself to a hospital instead of, healed himself. Right? I mean, isn't that kind of like a tacit admission that science works and his magic doesn't?
Yes.
You know?
The most interesting thing was, he had to go to a hospital, not to a prayer home. That's something we try to tell people, that when you are ill, you have been praying to Satya Sai Baba. But now, look at the Godhead himself. He's in a hospital taking medical care. But above the whole thing, we have been mainly critical of Satya Sai Baba because of his miracle claims. He was like a street magician. He would simply move his hand, produce holy ash, which is part of Hindu belief system, and which was given as a medicine to a lot of people. So if the common people are visiting him, he would simply produce holy ash and give to them. And if some rich politician reaches him, he would give a golden chain or ring, and which many politicians have been very proudly showing around. But we found very clearly that his miracles are simply sleight of hand, and mainly were very successful before the times of modern television. The television cameras caught him.
Yeah, I saw that on Guru Busters. It was, it's like you said, sleight of hand, but in that case, it didn't even look like he was very skillful. He was, like, kind of clumsily reaching underneath a prize he was giving out to grab a necklace, and it was really obvious. I mean, why did the network decide not to broadcast that? Have you looked into that?
I was not in their function, but, you know, that was his birthday, and the kind of audience that he had on that birthday included the President of India, Shankardayal Sharma, the Prime Minister of India, Narasimha Rao, and the Chief Justice, the Judiciary, Executive, and the Government, all were there at his feet, and the State Chief Minister also was there. And he had this miracle, and the television cameras caught this thing, and we had only state television at that time. And they did not telecast it. And the cameraman took a VHS copy and smuggled it out. And it reached us. When we got the copy, we made hundreds of copies and distributed. And first it appeared in Guru Busters. Then, of course, it has been shown all around the world. And later we got in television recording how he makes holy ash, how a small tablet of ash is kept in between his fingers, and how he's taking it in between the thumb and the palm and crushing it to produce the holy ash. Everything we could see in television recordings later, which we have shown everywhere, virtually everywhere in the country. But still, the common believer would say, well, I don't believe it. I believe he's God. That was a very strange situation sometime.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we're all, you know, very glad that you're keeping up the good work over there. And do you have anything else to add, or?
Well, I think it's a big struggle. It's not, it's a long struggle. I mean, in case of India, because we have a long tradition of blind belief and traditions and superstitions. And though India is coming out from traditions and to modernity, we live in India at the 21st century at one side. Everything that is modern, everything that is, developed in the world, we have at one part of India available. Simultaneously, we have a 16th century existing in India. This contradiction between the 16th century and 21st century is what we are trying to address, and that's the biggest task we have.
Great. All right, thanks a lot, Sunil Edamaruku. Yeah. And be sure to check out the links we have on the post for this interview. And thanks again. Have a nice day.
Thank you very much.